Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Hello and welcome everybody to Helping Young Children in Military Families Coping with Deployment and Trauma, part of the Treating the Invisible Wounds of War series, which is a collaboration between the Coming Home Project, UCSF Health Effect of War Grand Rounds program, and UCTV. My name is Joseph Bobro, and I'm the founder and president of the Coming Home Project, psychologist, psychoanalyst, and meditation teacher. Presently, I will introduce our presenter, Dr. Alicia Lieberman. But before I do, I want to speak a little bit about the Coming Home Project and our activities helping service members, veterans, families, and children, and also their care providers related to Iraq and Afghanistan deployments. We are a multidisciplinary team of psychotherapists, veterans, and interfaith leaders and military chaplains, and we're devoted to addressing the unseen injuries of war. Our programs are multiple. We have a cohort of 60 licensed and trained therapists in Northern California who provide pro bono psychological counseling for families, children, veterans, and service members. And we also offer a continuum of educational and supportive services as well, including support groups. Right now, we have one for parents going on in the North Bay. Perhaps the flagship of our program are residential retreats, where we bring together veterans, service members, and their families and children in beautiful conference centers off the beaten path, and they get a chance to enjoy sharing their stories and experiences, learning stress management and wellness techniques that they can take with them, creative expression, outdoor recreation, and children have their own programs, and the adults meet amongst themselves. So it's an opportunity to connect with themselves, with their peers, with their family members, and with their community as well. For more information about the Coming Home Project, please go to our website, ComingHomeProject.net. And the last element of our program is training for mental health professionals and other service providers. And this training is one of those projects. I'm delighted to be able to introduce one of the foremost experts on trauma and young children in particular, Dr. Alicia Lieberman. Dr. Lieberman is currently the director of the Early Trauma Treatment Network, or ETTN, a collaboration of four university sites that include the UCSF San Francisco General Child Trauma Research Project, Boston Medical Center, Louisiana State University Medical Center, and Tulane University. ETTN is funded by the Federal Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, or SAMHSA, as part of the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, a 50-site national initiative that has the mission of increasing the access and quality of services for children exposed to trauma in the United States. As a trilingual, tricultural Jewish Latina, Dr. Alicia Lieberman has a special interest in cultural issues involving child development, child rearing, and child mental health. She lectures extensively on these topics nationally and in four continents. And she has been very involved in helping military families as well in ways that perhaps she will speak a little bit about. We're delighted to introduce Dr. Alicia Lieberman.
Thank you. It's a privilege to speak about this very important topic. And I would like to start with some organizing figures, which is that most of the service members in our military are parents. And the majority of them are young parents. For example, 41% of service members in active duty have children that range from birth to 5 years of age, which means that while grappling with the monumental issues of life and death involved in war, they are also entering the developmental stage of parenthood, which in everyday life is already a very energy-consuming enterprise. And while one is also dealing with the issues involved with war, can often become overwhelming. In addition, we know that there is a high level of stress among our service members. 14% of them have met criteria for depression. An equal figure meet criteria for PTSD. Of those, two-thirds meet criteria for both conditions together, so they exacerbate each other. And almost one-fifth have traumatic brain injury. So this is a context that reminds us that whenever we think of helping children, we also need to think of including the parents, because we know that the best predictor of how children are functioning is how the parents are functioning and the extent to which the parents can be involved in growth-promoting ways. And so everything I say will have the implication of involving the parents in whatever work we're doing to help the children. We do use an ecological transactional model of development. We usually tend to think of development in terms of the baby's development, the young child's development, the adolescent's development. But in fact, we know that development never occurs only within the individual. It is affected in major ways by the family context, the neighborhood context, and the cultural context. And so in our interventions, we need to be constantly scanning the child's family, environment, and community to see how those influences are affecting the child's behavior. I needed to learn a lot when I started becoming involved in helping to produce materials for military families with the culture of the military. And I was impressed by learning about the importance of values such as service to country, fortitude in the face of adversity, and emphasis on community belonging, on community cohesiveness, as organizing values for families receiving services. And so the services that we offer need to also be imbued with those basic values that are so precious to the families that we serve. Within the military culture, we also need to remember that our military really is a microcosmos of our country, and that there is a large percentage of ethnic and racial minority service members, many of whom are themselves first-generation Americans who are becoming acculturated into the larger cultural environment. And so the whole question of how the military culture interfaces with the specific child-rearing values of the ethnic and racial groups of the families that we serve is also an important component of our work. One thing I'd like to remind ourselves of is the universality across different cultures of the expectable early anxieties, which are the fear of loss, the fear of losing love and approval, fear of body damage, and fear of not being a good person, fear of not measuring up. And we know that fear of loss is particularly salient in the first 18 months of life. Fear of losing love and approval begins to really become salient at about 18 months and becomes increasingly higher at peaks at about 2 to 2.5 years of age, but then continues quite steadily throughout our lifetime, and it really becomes the basis of our moral conscience, our tendency to believe that we should behave in ways that are acceptable to our community. And in fact, the fear of not measuring up, of not being a good person, has its earliest underpinnings in the fear of not being loved or not being approved of. And of course, fear of body damage starts becoming quite high when the baby starts to toddle and starts falling and hurting himself or hurting herself, and that also becomes increasingly heightened as the child begins to realize that he or she is responsible often for monitoring safety. All of these fears stay with us throughout our lifetime, and they go up or down depending on the safety of our surroundings and the safety of our relationships. For parents who are facing deployment or facing the deployment of their loved ones, each of these fears becomes heightened, often at the very time that the fears of their children are playing out in intense ways. And so here again, in order to alleviate children's anxieties and help to modulate them and cope with them, we need to find ways of helping the parents with their anxieties as they are going through them. We need to remember that across different ages, there are different expressions of these normative anxieties, so that while children in the birth to five age range might have temper tantrums, separation anxiety, defiance, new fears, children in school might have more problems paying attention to their classes, getting along with peers, and children in adolescence might engage in self-endangering experimentation, for example, with sex or with drugs and alcohol, rebellion, and self-doubt. But I'd like to highlight in my examples the first 5 years of life because they are still underrepresented among clinicians, and we tend to forget that even when we treat adolescents or school-age children, often there are siblings at home that are in the first 5 years of life and that are being influenced by the atmosphere in the home. There's also a misconception that is quite pervasive that young children are too little to understand, that they do not remember, and that they are so resilient that they pick themselves up and go on developing in spite of whatever it is that happens to them. After working with children in this age range since 1976, I can tell you that memory exists at many layers, and the children really do remember from a very early age. Regardless of the commonalities of early anxieties, it's also true, I believe, that it's always inaccurate to speak in generalities about how to help children and their parents because there are huge individual differences. And these individual differences have to do with the child's age, gender, temperament, the quality of the relationship with each parent, the family supports and vulnerabilities, and the community resources, whether material or sociocultural. And so here again, the ecological transactional model of development that I referred to at the beginning is relevant to remember. We've been talking about children. What are the normative parental functions? They are protection from danger, caring for the child, providing caregiving, and last but not least, socializing the child into the values of the community. The energy, the motivation of parents to engage in all of these complex tasks is affected by anxieties and stresses having to do with pre-deployment, anticipating deployment for themselves or their loved ones, deployment, having to be away or raise a child by themselves when one's partner is away, and the stresses of reunion. And we are going to be talking about these stages, but across all these stages, the overarching goal that we need to seek in our interventions is safety in the child's relationship with the parents and safety in the child's relationship with him or herself. We need to remember also that regardless of whether there is deployment, the ordinary stresses of everyday life go on. Life does not stop because a parent is away or because one is waiting for the parent to return. Children start school, they get in trouble with the teachers or with their peers, or they need to be potty trained, or they need to start eating solid foods, etc., etc., etc. All of these milestones acquire a different emotional coloration in the stresses that accompany deployment and, in worse circumstances, the injury or death of the service member. And so this is part of what we're going to talk about today. We'll start with the issue of anticipating deployment. And in the period preceding the service member's deployment, nobody knows how to feel. There is a going back and forth between anticipatory grief over the separation, fear about what will happen, while at the same time wanting to remain strong and wanting to show fortitude and hopefulness in the face of uncertainty. There's also a great deal to do. A lot of practical things having to do with finances, having to do with who will take on the roles that the parent about to be deployed fulfilled in the family. And so parents often immerse themselves in the everyday duties that they need to get done and tend to move away, perhaps as a self-protective response, from focusing on the impending goodbye. And yet, it's extremely important for children to find ways of saying goodbye to their parents. I am remembering a mother who was about to be deployed, who told her 3-year-old little girl, "I have to go away because it is part of my job." And she told her this about 3 weeks before she was deployed in order to give the child time to digest this enormous piece of information. And in the intervening weeks, she talked about how she would always think of the child, how she would always love the child, how she would call whenever she could, would write letters whenever she could. And she also made videotapes and audiotapes of herself telling stories, singing lullabies, playing with the child, and those audio tapes were played by the father when the child went to sleep and when the child was having a great deal of difficulty being put to bed by the father instead of by the mother, which was the daily routine before deployment. She also, the mother, also made sure that she spent time alone with the child and that the family spent time together. And they were explicitly building memories that could be talked about during the period of deployment. In the first month apart, everybody in the family had a roller coaster of emotions. The father was alternatively missing his wife and angry at her for being in the military, even though it had been a family decision, and guilty about feeling angry. And his moods were constantly monitored by this little three-year-old who consistently blamed herself if her father was out of sorts and would say, "Are you angry with me?" And the father would say, "No, why would I be angry with you?" And the child would say, "Because you look so serious." And the father, through this dialogue, realized that everything he did, the child attributed to her own influence, and started trying to really monitoring his own behavior so that when he was around the child, he tried to maintain a balance of emotions. The little girl had her own experience. Often her gaze was lost in the distance. Her face was often just as serious as the father's face was. She looked sad. She had low energy. She started carrying the mother's purse all around the house, and she jumped whenever the phone rang or the doorbell rang. She did not forget, and she kept inside of her a constant compass of the mother's presence. And the father would say, "She's so little. Do you think she really is feeling all of these things?" "Yes, children have very deep feelings. And the more we respect those feelings, the more we will help them become whole, wholesome human beings." In the months following deployment, everybody needed to learn, or off deployment, the long months of deployment, everybody had to learn to live with uncertainty while fearing the loss, the worst. Loss of love. Will she forget me? Will she get hurt? Are we doing well in her absence? Are we measuring up? And this is particularly difficult because many times weeks go by before the service member can call for the first time or make contact for the first time. And then, of course, one is greatly relieved. And then after hanging up, one realizes that danger lurks from the moment they hung up the phone. And so there is all the uncertainty again until the next communication. And so the coping strategies need to be to be in touch with the feelings of worry and concern, but also maintaining a sense of hopefulness and engagement with the everyday tasks of life. And this is, I think, where the military culture can teach us so much in terms of being able to feel, but also being able to remain engaged with the prevailing duty of the jobs that they undertake. In this particular case, we help the father maintain the continuity of daily routines, which for children of whatever age is a key factor in normal healthy development. It's so easy to give up on things like washing the dishes after dinner because one just doesn't have the energy to do that, or getting to school on time, or doing homework in a timely manner, or maintaining contact with the daycare teacher when the daycare teacher wants to report on how the child is doing, etc., etc. It's also very easy to give up on discipline and to indulge children who one sees as suffering so much. And we're not doing children a favor by becoming lax in discipline, because discipline and social expectations and living up to social expectations is really a way of building emotional muscles and provide the child with a framework and a sense of accountability and responsibility that makes the child feel competent and strong. It's also very important to involve the deployed parent in everyday life to the extent that that is possible. And here there is a delicate balance between not overwhelming apparent in a danger zone with intractable problems or with overwhelming emotional situations, while at the same time asking for constructive problem solving so that the service member feels that he's still needed, that she's still wanted, that she's still a member of the family. And this is particularly important in light of findings that after reunion, service members self-report in 40% of the cases feeling like a guest in the household and complaining that the children are not warm or are angry with them or afraid of them. They are unsure of their role in the household. They report that the partner is afraid of them, and this is self-reports. And in a whopping 54% of the cases, they report shouting, pushing, shoving. After anticipating the reunion with such eagerness, the reunion is often fraught with conflict and ambivalence. And the parent often feels that both parents, one, the at-home parent feels that they don't know how to include the returning parent, and the returning parent often feels that they don't know how they belong now in a family that managed to go on without their presence. About 3% of military families actually report domestic violence. So I think that it's important to remember, and this is serious domestic violence involving weapons. About 10% report what's called moderate domestic violence, which involves the pushing, shoving, hitting, etc. But even so-called moderate domestic violence is extremely frightening for the children. And the juxtaposition of a long absence followed by a stormy reunion, the dashing of the idealized image of what things would be like after the parent comes back, and then the frightening scenes of physical conflict or emotional shouting matches between the parents is a very damaging effect. We also know that there is an overlap between different sources of violence, so that depending on the particular samples, there is about a 40 to 70% overlap between domestic violence and child abuse. And so I think it behooves all of us to find tactful ways, respectful ways of inquiring with the parents about the emotional climate of the home and asking whether there is domestic violence or whether there is child maltreatment. And of course, it's a very good idea not to use jargon such as domestic violence or child maltreatment. In our own work with pregnant women, we found out that if we say things like, when you get angry with each other, is there any kind of pushing or shoving or slapping, or in other words, using concrete words rather than conceptual categories. And when we learned that, the disclosure of domestic violence went up from 5% to 65% in a very high-risk population. What happens when tragedy strikes? And here is when we deal with trauma. We use a very classic definition of trauma, initially crafted by Freud and continues to be used by people like Bob Pinos and Bessel van der Kolk, where a traumatic event is defined as overwhelming the capacity to cope because it threatens the life or physical integrity of the person, and it is characterized by happening unpredictably, causing horror, and causing helplessness. One doesn't have access to one's regular coping resources. And of course, one of the most common sources of trauma for families in the military is parental injury, which cause a change in the roles that are played out in the family, how the injured service member fits in the family. And for children, it also creates a sense of, this is not the parent that I was waiting for. So after the long months of waiting for the parent, the fading of real memories about the healthy parent in interaction with the child, the construction of idealized memories during the parent's absence of, this is how it's going to be when my daddy or my mommy come back, the actual return is the return of a parent who is not the same parent who left and who the child is hoping for. And so the parent and the child and the parents as partners to each other need to find new ways of relating to each other. The most serious form of trauma, of course, is parental death. And depending on the child's age, we need to find developmentally appropriate ways of explaining what death is. We know that 2-3-year-olds do not know about the permanence of death, the fact that death is forever. And so in addition to mourning the death, the remaining family members need to be able to tell the child that the parent will not come back. It's really important to identify a reliably surrogate caregiver and to preserve reassuring memories of the parent. And I will talk a little more about that later in my talk. But it's very important also to anticipate and be ready to respond the inevitable questions that the child has, particularly children 5 and under, who, as I said before, think that the world really revolves around what they are doing and who instantly remember things that might not have been so harmonious in the parent-child relationship and start worrying that they in some way caused the parent's death. And of course, they start anticipating the fear that the remaining parent will also die and that they will also die. In a few cases, we also had children who want to die because they want to join daddy or mommy in heaven. And in the midst of helping the child with the death and accept the finality of death, one has to also do the almost contradictory role of maintaining an ongoing connection with the memory of the parent so that the child continues to incorporate that very important experience in the next stages of development. I talked before about whether young children remember, and we know that they might not be able to talk about their memories if they are pre-verbal, but one well-established research finding is that children often speak in very articulate ways about things that happened to them when they pre-verbal, once they acquire language. We also need to remember that children understand much more language than they can speak. And so narrating reality for the children is really a way of building their ego strength and their mental health. Traumatic stress occurs at all ages. It's only recently that we've begun to really understand and identify the characteristics of traumatic stress in young children. We have very similar clusters as traumatic stress in older children and in adults, mainly re-experiencing trauma, numbing in the form of social withdrawal and play constriction, increased arousal, and new symptoms. I want to highlight the importance of screening and being alert to post-traumatic stress, because it is often misdiagnosed as ADHD. Given the popularity of ADHD as a diagnosis in our current psychiatric and psychological landscape, I find that it's often the case that a diagnosis is given without asking what the child's everyday experiences have been like, without asking whether this child has suffered a recent loss, whether they have witnessed violence. And I think this is particularly important to remember in children who are living in families at the verge of exposure to danger, including families who live in very dangerous neighborhoods where there is a lot of community violence. In all this, I'll repeat again that caregivers have been identified in research as being the key factor in decreasing child symptomatology, enhancing school performance, and promoting social skills. And along these lines, then, the developmental objectives of promoting safety in the relationship and safety in the self has to do with affect regulation and reciprocity in the parent-child relationship. And I'll give you an example of a five-year-old who was anticipating with great joy his father's return home from Iraq after a nine-month deployment. During the weeks preceding the father's return, the child spoke in great detail about all the things that he and his father would do together, highlighting in particular how his father would teach him to play catch with a ball. The child's mother could not bring herself to tell him that the father had suffered injuries that affected his mobility. When the child eagerly asked his father after the reunion about playing catch, he burst into tears when his father told him that he could not do it, and the child ran out of the room yelling, "Go away, I don't love you." This episode marked a turning point for the worse in family relationships. The mother angrily told the son to apologize, and the son mumbled that he was sorry, but soon afterwards started wetting the bed and getting in trouble in his kindergarten, while the father became increasingly despondent, withdrawn, and sad. In individual and joint family therapy sessions, the grief, anger, shame, and guilt that the family members experienced about the father's injury could be expressed and modulated. In one particularly important session, the child started limping around the room, and the father said, "Are you hurt?" The child answered yes, and the father asked him to come close so that he could look at the child's foot. As the father was examining him, the child said, "How did you get hurt?" This had been an unaddressed topic in the family before this session. Taken aback, the father stayed silent, but the child persisted and said, "How did you get hurt?" And then the therapist intervened and said, "You really care about your dad, and you want to know what happened to him." And this seemed to trigger in the father a sense of, oh, when he said he didn't love me, that was a temporary state of mind. Maybe he does care about me. Maybe he does want to listen. And in a shaky voice, he said, "There was a bad man that shot me with a gun." And the child, in a five-year-old way, said, "Did you kill him?" And the father answered, "No, but my friend did." And then he took some toy soldiers that were on the floor and started to enact the scene. And the child came very close to him and leaned against him while looking. And then after a few minutes of watching, he joined in. And father and child became immersed in an involved play sequence where good guys were attacked by bad guys and fought back again and again. As they were leaving, the child spontaneously took the father's hand and started walking down the hall without limping. The father noticed and said, "Is your foot all better?" And the child nodded yes. This play sequence brought relief both to the father and to the child and opened up a new way of interacting with each other. About 2 weeks after this session, the father said to the therapist, "You know, I realized that I might not be able to catch ball, but I can throw the ball from my wheelchair." And so the child and the parent had this routine where they would go to the yard and the father would throw the ball and the child would catch it and then bring it back to the father. So that they found a way of adapting that met the condition of the father and met the need of the child. It also, this play sequence, I believe, opened up for them the realization that they could play together in symbolic ways. And their play acquired this elaborate tone of danger and protection from danger and the good guys prevailing over the bad guys. So this is one example of how we want to validate traumatic responses as universal and understandable, and helping the co-creation of a trauma narrative where children are able to talk about the unspeakable with their parents. One aspect that was very interesting here is that this child had started avoiding balls and had refused to play ball at the school and did not approach the ball at home until the father was able to start engaging in this game. So identifying traumatic reminders and finding ways of coping with them is, I think, a very important aspect of the treatment. Another component, of course, is engagement with the everyday tasks of life, and that means engaging in learning so that there is continued pleasure in the new milestones that come about. I want to emphasize the importance of matching the services that we offer with the services that the parent needs and that the child needs so that normative stress can be met with preventive efforts, good childcare, good schools, access to resources, stress that is emotionally costly with intervention. But when there is trauma, I think that treatment is really a very important a form of intervention. I think that it's important to realize that if we feel overwhelmed by the enormity of the job, we need to take heart in the fact that small changes do matter. For this parent and child, this father and child that I described, this small change made a tremendous difference in restoring trust and communication between them. When we make mistakes, whether as parents or as therapists, we can repair them. Sometimes there's more value in the repair than in the initial perfection. And we don't need to be a therapist to be therapeutic. We all need each other. And I think we need to start defining ourselves as members and collaborators in a therapeutic community. And here I want to thank the Coming Home Project, because that is a project that really builds community. And I also want to thank two other resources that I'd like to bring to your attention. One is the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, which has a marvelous website that you can access by typing in NCTSN, Military Families and Children website. and 0-3, which is the National Center for Infants, Toddlers, and Families in Washington, D.C., which is engaged in a phenomenal effort across the country to provide support to families and service providers for children 0-3. And they have a marvelous kit that they distribute to families addressing the challenges that they face during deployment and after reunion. And you can get more information about this by contacting Dr. Lynette Fraga, who is the director of the Coming Together Around Military Families. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to you, Dr. Lieberman, for a wonderful presentation and very timely and heartfelt. There are a couple of questions from our virtual audience, at a distance audience, that I'd like to read to you.
Okay.
And in the remaining time, you can respond to those. And also, if there are any questions from our audience. But we have a question from Karen Harris, which she emailed in, and she writes, I'm a mother of a 19-month only boy. My husband, his daddy, will be deploying in a month to Afghanistan for 1 year. I wonder if you might address what I can do for his deployment level to help him cope with his daddy being gone. I know that during the time of his dad's deployment, he will also need to go through some milestones like weaning from breastfeeding. He currently nurses before a nap and before bedtime and when he wakes in the morning. Around the age of 2, or maybe later, he will transition to a toddler bed and possibly will look at beginning potty training. With all these things in mind, can you give moms like me some things we can do or say to help our little ones? And she, yes, to help our little ones. So that's the first question.
I want to tell this mom that the very fact that she's asking these questions already shows how well prepared she is to respond to her child in the ways that the child will need her to. Celebrating the milestones, continue to expect milestones and to work towards milestones, while also acknowledging that the first thing that go are milestones when a toddler is having a hard time. So there might be a refusal to be toilet trained, refusal to give up the breast, and it seems to me that she might want to think of transitions that will need to happen soon after the father is deployed and see whether they can happen before the father is deployed so that there isn't an emphasis on doing something very difficult for the child at the same time that the child is struggling with the separation from the father, because children tend to cling to what is familiar to them when they are struggling with another task. So I think that is something to keep in mind, and I really would like you, madam, to contact 0-3 and to make use of the resources that 0-3 has available, because your question seems tailor-made for the kind of effort that 0-3 is engaging in to help mothers like you. Thank you for your very thoughtful, sensitive question.
I have another question from Karen Wrigley, who is a social worker in Norristown, Pennsylvania. And she writes, and I think speaks for many psychotherapists, as she asks, how do you recommend therapists support military families with their initial deployment situation and also assist in their adjustment with reintegration?
I hope that I touched on some of these questions in the course of my talk. I think that normalizing the roller coaster of emotions during deployment and emphasizing the importance before deployment of leaving time free just to be and to feel together, so that time is not spent only doing practical things, but it's also spent building memories that are going to be sustaining during the time that the service member is away. And in terms of helping with reunion, I think anticipating the stresses that are inherent after a separation and the fact that everybody changes during time away, everybody finds ways of coping with not being together, and counseling and modeling patience in accommodating back to each other and trying to deconstruct little by little the idealizations of the reunion that are bound to happen in preparing for it.
Anybody in our live audience have a question? Yes, please.
I'd be interested to hear more about the cultural differences between...
Thank you for your question. I'm hardly an expert in the military culture. I don't live within the military culture. So I'm going to tell you my experience just as an example of what happened. When I met with some people from... who do live within the military culture, who grew up in the military culture, and who now are working within the military, they wanted to talk with me about working with military families and preparing materials about grief and the mourning of injury and death. And I was all ready to do that. And they showed me the materials that they had prepared, and I thought that they were too sunny, that they were too optimistic, that they did not speak about the emotional collapse that can happen when one is facing injury. And we were spending 3 days together. The first day consisted of my trying to persuade them to put more depth, quote unquote. And then towards the end of the day, they said to me, I think we have a cultural difference here. We emphasize proactive coping and do not emphasize dwelling on nuances of emotion. So, as we collaborate together, let's try to figure out how we can integrate what we represent, which is families that want us to tell them what they can do, and what you are trying to say, which is take time to feel, take time to reflect, etc., etc. So that is a lesson that I continue to carry with me, and I've attended many lectures by returning service members, both wounded and not wounded, and I have to tell you that for me it's been an enormous new step in my own acculturation in this country, getting to know the courage and the patriotism and the solid family values, real family values of the service men and women in the military, and I am learning from them.
I'm afraid we need to draw things to a close. I'd like to make one brief announcement before we do. Those of you who might be here or might be listening and are mental health professionals or military chaplains and are interested in exploring becoming a facilitator for one of the Coming Home Project's retreats. We're having a facilitator training conference in November. You can learn more about it at our website, cominghomeproject.net. I would like to thank you, Dr. Lieberman, for a wonderful presentation full of real life and knowledge and usable kind of knowledge that we can take with us in helping our military families and children. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.